Hi, I'm Rachel Church. I'm editorial director at the World Academy of Sport. And for those of you who might not know us, we run educational programs, learning pathways, etc., for major sports rights owners and international federations. We have offices in Switzerland, UK, Australia, USA, Canada, so quite global. And we also have a partnership with the International Paralympic Committee. We run the observers program during the Paralympics. And that was a great success. Recently, we had and hosted over 400 representatives from Beijing, Pyeongchang, Tokyo, as well as some of the candidate cities for the future games, and lots of other organisers too, from Pan American Games, etc. So that was a great success. And actually, there are some people in the room who were there. So now, before I introduce my panellists, I was asked to just say a few words about the industry at the moment and some trends that we're seeing in the area of the panel that we're discussing. I mean, what I've noticed, some of the work I've done over the years is the increase, and that's mostly through the Ultimate Sports Cities Awards that I used to judge for sport business. And that's the increasing role of cultural events sitting under the same umbrella as sports events. You know, they're not seen in isolation anymore. Creating a balanced portfolio, and I know Paul Bush mentioned that yesterday in the opening session. There's also definitely an increase in entertainment and sport. I've had great fun over the years working with the likes of the PDC on the darts, Drift All-Stars in motor racing, and also the NFL. And really seeing the use of music, imagery, engagement with fans in a more sort of prolific manner than just turning up and sitting in your seat like we would have done back in the day. So definitely more engagement and entertainment within sports events. And then within that, the use of technology and social media as well is increasing. We're also seeing, and this will be one of the things we talk about during this panel, is the increasing role of venues becoming entertainment complexes in their own right as well. So becoming either multi-use venues or becoming part of complexes which have lots of different things going on. And the O2 is a great example of that, and we'll hear more about that. We're also seeing an increase in cities making more use of outdoor spaces for events as well, and really using the landscape of the city as a backdrop. We saw lots of that here in Glasgow during the Commonwealth Games and use of those outdoor spaces to great effect. In Auckland, just using a New Zealand example, during the Rugby World Cup in 2011, the fan zone that was created between Auckland and Eden Park, which was nearly 5 kilometres of music, festival, entertainment, Kermit the Frog. I mean, what more could you want? Just to engage with those fans who didn't even have tickets for that event, but were happy to take part in that fan zone and walk up to the venue. And then finally as well, I had the great pleasure earlier this year of going to the launch of Jurassic World in Melbourne. Who says I have a rubbish job? It was fantastic. So seeing firsthand how museums are now bidding for major events as well to host in their cities and also creating their own. You know, Belfast, I don't know if any of you have been to the Titanic experience there, but just really engaging with visitors in a unique way using technology. So those are a few trends which hopefully we'll pick up on during this panel. And I'd now like to introduce, starting from the far side there, John Langford. Welcome, John. He's Vice President and General Manager of the O2 in London, just hosted the tennis, as we heard yesterday, and welcomed, I think, Ian, you said, over 2.5 million. A lot of visitors over the last few days, a lot, for the ATP World Tour Finals. And prior to that, John was Director of Live Entertainment here in Glasgow for the SECC and SSE Hydro, Armadillo, as you guys know, and then COO at Big Concerts in Cape Town. Welcome, John. Next to John, we have Devorah Bloomberg, who's head of New Zealand major events, and she advises the New Zealand government on the value of the events industry, how that brings value to the economy, and partners with the events sectors to bring events into New Zealand. And her background includes public policy and tourism policy. Welcome, Devorah, and then also Ian, who's Ian Edmondson, head of major events at London and Partners, who I've known for many years through Ultimate Sports Cities, having won in 2012 and 2014 and winning major categories in those rankings and awards. And London and Partners is the Mayor of London's promotional organisation for the capital, and Ian's role is to secure long-term major event opportunities for that, and we'll be hearing more about those. So welcome to the panel. I'd like to kick off, actually, in view of what the subject of this panel is, using their own examples and experience, how do they define what actually is a good experience for visitors? How would you even define a visitor? I know, John, you have some views on that. And what do they see as the key touch points for engagement throughout that cycle for the fan. So John, perhaps starting with you, if I may.
Yeah, I think the first thing that stood out for me was the definition of visitors. I think it's easy to assume that the visitor is the ticket-buying public, but certainly in my world, the visitor extends beyond just the ticket-buying public. You know, it's the artist on stage, it's their crew, it's the support team that comes along with that. And I think if we just pigeonhole ourselves into seeing visitors as the ticket-buying public and just being on a very linear experience engagement point, I think we're limiting ourselves. So certainly if I look at a typical live entertainment show, you know, we've just confirmed Bruno Mars is coming in March, but the conversations are already starting with the team as to what kind of engagement we're having with them, not just as a venue, but also as a city. So Justin Bieber's in town this week in London. We've got over 500 hotel rooms booked just for the Justin Bieber crew. So just from that perspective, I think it's key to just be how we define visitors is a really good starting point for determining our engagement with them.
And in terms then of how you engage with them and at what point onwards do you stop engaging with them?
Yeah, again, I think it's easy to think that our engagement starts when they buy the ticket or when they wake up that morning and decide that they're going to catch a train through to the O2. But actually, the engagement starts far earlier than that. I'll use a Bruno Mars example. I mean, the event's only next year in March, but the engagement with a lot of people is happening this week when they actually hear about the tour. And some of that is controlled by us and some of that isn't controlled by us. And I think that's also key to bear in mind, is that we've got some owned media, of course, we've got earned media and we're buying media, but there are things beyond our control that are happening about the engagement. Again, I'll use Justin Bieber as another example. Actually, Kanye West is probably an even better example. Kanye West was in the news this morning about supporting Donald Trump and cancelling his shows in Los Angeles, but yet he's planning a tour to the UK next year, and I'm thinking to myself, shit, what am I going to have to deal with by the end of the week when the tour is announced? You know, are we going to sell tickets? Are people going to hold back and kind of go, well, hell, what's he going to do on stage? I don't know. So a whole lot of this is beyond our influence and control.
And apologies for the bad language there. And of course, I mean Justin Bieber. Devorah, what about your perspective from a country viewpoint in terms of touch points and a good visitor experience?
I think it's useful to consider the visitor experience from the before, the during, and the after. So there's that Maya Angelou quote, people will forget what you did and what you said, but they'll never forget the way you made them feel. And I think a visitor experience is very much about, you know, the way that visitor feels when engaging with the event. So when you think about the before the event, from whether it's from point of sale, the engagement with that consumer, the information provision, I think that's really, really important. An example from, say, Auckland, Rachel touched on it, the Rugby World Cup 2011. Auckland doesn't have a really comprehensive underground metro that a lot of major cities have, so transport was always going to be an issue for people engaging with that event. So the council's decision to do a 4.5-kilometre fan trail from the major train bus terminal right through to the stadia was a brilliant decision, because people engaged with it even if they weren't going to the event, but they walked along that 4.5 kilometres being entertained all the way by pop-up, you know, dance crews and all sorts of different types of entertainment, and it made their experience amazing even before they got to the event. Then, of course, you've got the during the event, which is things like, you know, obviously there's the magic of the event itself, but you know, who of you in the room have been a bit miffed by having to wait too long in a bathroom queue because people haven't thought about how many bathrooms are required, or portable bathrooms, or the cost of merchandise or wine and food, or not having enough sort of event ambassadors dotted around to answer questions. So that's also, you know, the way a visitor engages with an event is the assistance and experience provided to them. And then, of course, there's the following the event, which is making sure that you learn, you capture their experience, you survey them, and you learn from the mistakes. You know, apply it, if it's a recurring event, to the next year, or apply it to another large-scale event. So I think it is really important to consider that experience all the way through.
Ian, NFL have been in town three times in recent weeks, perhaps using that as an example, but other examples. So how do London consider the visitor journey?
Yeah, well, the NFL are a big investor in London and staging their regular season games in London since 2007. They held one regular season game, and they now hold three regular season games. More than half the 32 franchise teams that play in the NFL have now played a game in London over the past 9-10 years. And we're hopeful that there'll be four regular season games from next year at a different stadium now across London. So they are making big steps towards, the NFL as a franchise are probably one of the top examples of fan engagement, of caring about the experience from every little detail. I mean, it is phenomenal. I've met the owner of the Jacksonville Jaguars that looked at what it would take to have a stadium in London suited to their expertise and their eye for detail. And they were telling me about the customer experience they've built into their stadium in Jacksonville, which includes a swimming pool on the top, so you can buy your ticket, literally be like in a jacuzzi in an endless pool looking at the game. It's true. It's not. I'm not making this up. This happens, and that's just a whole level of beyond comprehension kind of fan experience. But if you think about everything on the pitch to orchestrating the moments the anthems are sung, the moments the teams get introduced, everything is orchestrated down to the finest art of detail. And they've grown their franchise, they've grown their product, they've grown their audience because they've applied that professionalism and detail and entertainment to it. So when they come to London, they want to have a wider engagement than is just the ticket fans, that the 84,000 that might be going to Wembley Stadium. So they invest in using some of our public spaces. So we have Regent Street for one time a year now, closed between Oxford Circus and Piccadilly Circus, a footprint of hundreds of thousands of people. They have a big fan engagement that's more than just for the fans that are going to the game. That's for the wider public. That's to grow their audience, grow their brand. But from a London point of view, we want to do more. We want to engage because one of the things that we did well during the games was, for example, the volunteering. We had 7,000 volunteers in the city in addition to the games volunteers that made people welcome. It addressed some of Devorah's points about making people welcome within the city. And the city's invested in keeping that product, that capability, and rolling it out for other things like the NFL fan zone on Regent Street. And it impacts the reputation, impacts the sort of long-term visitor appeal. And to say, who do we regard as visitors? Actually, we regard visitors as potential visitors, actual visitors to London throughout the year, potential visitors and potential investors or potential students. I work for an organisation that doesn't just encourage more visitors to London, but also more students to study in further education and more businesses to set up in London as well. And our metrics, we measure success on all of those factors. So it's way beyond the sort of 20,000 that might come and watch one performance at the O2, way beyond the 250,000 ticket purchases that came to the O2 for the tennis last week, into 19 million international visitors a year, and it's sort of record-breaking levels of international visitors, to people that might come in the future. So my job is actually way beyond the sort of individual, what is the ticket buyer's experience and can he go to the toilet, to actually we want to broadcast to the world that, and you'll have seen it, hashtag London is open, which is a big post-Brexit campaign to tell the rest of the world that we want people to continue to engage with London for tourism, for inward investment, for other things. So actually our job is so magnifyingly big when it comes to actually how do we define a visitor or a potential visitor, that we've got to sort of work in those levels on top of the venue and what they do with their particular addressing the detail to the franchises that address their audiences as well.
Sorry, I was just going to add a really good reflection of that for those of you that are visiting Glasgow at the moment, is pop down to Finiston if you get a bit of spare time this evening. It's a whole area of the city that's been really built up over the last 3-4 years on the back of the SSE Hydro and the Commonwealth Games. It's amazing how a venue has substantially changed the fabric and skyline of the city. You know, I moved to Scotland 4 years ago, and when I actually lived in Finistone, and the city, that aspect of the city that it is today is completely different to what it was 3-4 years ago. And that's a direct result of the city's investment in a venue and in events.
Sticking with you, John, just picking up on something Ian said about the close cooperation between London and the NFL. So, and I'll come back to you as well, Ian, but how closely do the venues, the cities, work with the rights owners when it comes to putting on a show?
I can speak probably better for Glasgow, considering I've only been at the O2 now for 4 weeks, so don't ask many difficult questions about the O2. But certainly in the case of Glasgow, the SECC, and the Hydro in particular, has got an incredibly close relationship with the city. So much of the content that has made the Hydro successful has been driven and supported by the city. And I think vice versa, you know, because of the nature of the build that is the SSE Hydro, so many events have come to the city that ordinarily may not have come in the past.
And Ian, for you, you mentioned the NFL, but in terms of the other events that come to London, is it a similar relationship with those? Does it vary from event to event?
Well, I mean, somewhere like the O2, they're, if not the most successful indoor venue in the world in terms of, you know, booking, it's one of the most successful in the world for bookings in their space, and they know the business well, and a lot of it's music business. And actually, in that example, they kind of look after themselves quite a lot. It's so evolved as a marketplace. But we try and work with the venues in the city, and that, you know, the vast majority of venues in London are privately owned or, you know, subsidiaries of other organisations rather than being under mayor control or mayor owned. So we sort of work on a more arm's length arrangement with quite a lot of what goes on, and we sort of try and add value as appropriate. But the really interesting examples that we're working on at the moment are public spaces where we haven't necessarily got a venue or a marketplace to fill events. And there's a couple of examples we've had this year where we had a light festival for the first time in Close Road, a lot of the iconic central London destinations. It was called Lumiere London, 4 nights in January, filling a point in time when it's, you know, can be a bit of a dip in terms of what goes on and people's mood and things like that. So we had 1 million people on the streets for, you know, it's public art, basically, actually lifting people's moods, sharing on social media. We had 1 million unique users to visitlondon.com through that event, as well as 1 million people on the streets and a sort of a lot broader reach in terms of social media sort of following and news that generated. And also in September, we had another public festival, which was a celebration of the Great Fire of London. So in 350 years ago, we had what was known as the Great Fire of London, where a large swathe of the footprint of the city was burnt down, and it kind of triggered the transformation of the city. It triggered the insurance industry that happens and is a big thriving financial services industry in London. We had a public celebration of that. The same producers that ran the Light Festival put on a public display. It was sponsored by various, an interesting mix of landowners and other philanthropic donations, some contribution from the city, to have a celebration, a public celebration of that moment. And it included, culminated on the Sunday evening, a scale model of the City of London, curated by the man that runs the Burning Man Festival in the States. It was beautifully designed and built by local apprentices, this scale model of London, put in the middle of the river and burnt. 6:30 on Sunday night, closed roads, free.
So how did you rehearse that?
Well, I mean, literally, it's an incredible illustration of what the city's open and capable to doing. Because you just think, and the health and safety environment of UK particularly, how can you ever imagine that's ever going to happen? And because of the cooperation we had around the Games, a legacy of people working together around the Games, they enabled it, made it happen. It's an incredibly moving experience. We live-streamed it on visitlondon.com, So we sort of reached our wider audience through doing new ways of working on Visit London. I had a little package edited and shown on national TV as well the following day. But it was an illustration of how we can start animating, how we can reach a broader audience through a different model. It isn't just franchises, you know, big investing sports franchises that are doing things. And in that example, you know, it was an incredibly moving experience. I was stood on the bank and, you know, maybe the window on the other side of the sort of cafe area here is where, you know, some of that was. And you could feel the heat coming off it. At one point when it got going, about half an hour later, the flames were above the height of this. And you're thinking, wow, this is just a scale model. You know, imagine what it was like with that side of London for a kilometre was on fire and you were on this side of the river. You just think...
Did you say that was free as well? So you didn't need tickets?
It was a public event. So, but it was incredibly moving. And it played back to another big installation some of us were talking about last night in the Tower of London. Some of you might have heard of the Poppies installation, a Remembrance Sunday installation, a public art. 600,000 people died in World War I, and there was a poppy planted for each of the 600,000 people that died around the moat of the Tower of London. And it was a symbolic gesture, but incredibly moving, incredibly engaging public art display. And they're things that, you know, tap into, you know, why we're a human society, why we're welcoming, why we care about each other, in a way that actually that's what major events do. You know, they demonstrate human interaction beyond just the product of the elite sport or the things or the fans following individual things. So for me, they're really interesting things. And there's some people in the room, you know, have got thoughts and ideas about how they do that. That's the power of major events. And if we can capitalize more than just because there's been a multi-billionaire owner of an NFL football team that can afford to close the roads and put on a big spectacle on, they're the real nuggets of opportunities as far as we're concerned.
Devorah, I know you have some comments on the use of public spaces, just going back to Ian's point about how that can be used. Obviously, earthquakes in Christchurch affecting the urban landscape there dramatically. How has Christchurch bounced back and how are they using urban spaces for cultural events, etc.?
Yeah, so in 2011, a really significant earthquake hit Christchurch in New Zealand, and Christchurch was this beautiful city that the people of Christchurch and visitors really engaged with that city because the centre of the city, there was a large square with a beautiful cathedral, and, you know, there was a lot of public celebrations in the city and so on, and the earthquake destroyed the city. It changed it forever. That cathedral was destroyed. And so initially the whole city was red zoned, it was shut. And the people that did used to engage with the city, either events and festivals were cancelled or they were pushed out into regions or into parks, into safer spaces. And so it really did change that landscape, not only, you know, the physical landscape, but people's mental landscape and the way they celebrated the city. So as time went on, though, the city started to open up and buildings that were dangerous were demolished. And so the cityscape itself sort of represented buildings that were safe and then empty lots where, you know, where buildings had been demolished. And it was sort of actually ripe for opportunity, but a very sort of surreal surreal landscape. But a number of creative minds came together and decided that they wanted to reimagine the city. And there was a professor of architecture who created what's called FESTA, which stands for the Festival of Transitional Architecture. And they decided that they were going to use that cityscape and they were going to bring people back into the city and celebrate it and have a massive party in this space. And there was large-scale art installations, giant puppets roaming the streets, light shows. They expected that 5,000 people would show up and 20,000 people showed up. So they knew that they were sort of onto a good thing, and it was a way to start re-engaging the people into the city, and over time, because the event is now annual, the event itself is evolving with the changing landscape. So as the city starts to regenerate and more buildings are going up, the festival is evolving. It initially was about celebrating and bringing people out of grief. Now it's about sustainability and reusing materials, which is obviously when you're, you know, pulling down buildings, what do you do with the materials? So it was it really has been an example of where something amazingly innovative has risen from a very tragic event.
And just staying with you, Devora, in terms of how New Zealand has bounced back from that, but also engaging the local population and making them proud of the cultural heritage, that was something else I know you wanted to talk about. So how does New Zealand build the culture into events?
Yeah, I think if every city has a competitive advantage, and whether that's a venue, or a really engaged public official, or you know, it's cityscape. There's something about every city that makes it completely different from all other cities, and that's the competitive advantage that should be built on and used to differentiate yourself and bring people to the city. So in New Zealand, of course, we've got a very, very strong Māori culture. So the indigenous people, the Māori people, that history and culture is very much embedded in the New Zealand sort of psyche. And so a lot of cities and events bring that culture into the event or to their city and tourism offering because that is what sets us apart from anywhere else in the world. You will not experience that indigenous culture anywhere else but New Zealand. So there's a particular city in New Zealand called Rotorua that has always been a tourist destination. Its landscapes have been built by a sort of volcanic history, undulating hills, geysers, mud pools. It's very unique. But in terms of events, the city has harnessed that uniqueness and put on events that really can integrate that. So, for example, the Crankworx, which is also in France and in Canada, Crankworx is a mountain biking festival. The riders say that the soil and mud in Rotorua is the best in the world, and they want to come in and ride on this soil. But not only that, the whole event, the participants are welcomed onto a marae, which is a traditional Māori meeting community, meeting house. They're welcomed by Māori warriors. There are beautiful Māori carvings in some of the jumps for the slopestyle event. It's a really good example of the way the culture has been integrated into an event. And moving on from that, my organisation is seed investing in a brand new event that will kick off next year, which is the working title, a mud festival. But this has been born out of an international relationship that Rotorua has with Bryong in Korea. I'm not sure if any of you have heard of the Bryong Mud Festival, but it attracts millions of people every year. And with Rotorua having this cultural history and this beautiful natural landscape, it makes sense for them to develop this international relationship and develop an event on that basis. So I think there's really good examples through Rotorua of the way that they integrate culture.
Thank you. Mindful of time, I know we start a little bit late, but we'll try and get time back on track. But you can start thinking about questions if you have any. But I'd just like to come to John and then Ian about their own take on the cultural aspect and building your identity, and maybe from a South African perspective for you, John.
Yeah, it's a bit mixed being South African, Scottish, and now living in London. But you know, certainly what I've learned.
Makes you a Londoner, no?
Yeah. Go Andy Murray. He's Scottish, by the way. Just putting that out there. Yeah, I think just picking up what Devora was saying is that there is certainly something unique about each culture and each city and each country that we should really celebrate. And you know, London is multicultural, and it's a fabulous melting pot, and that presents certain things. You know, Glasgow has got a very different cultural kind of position to Edinburgh, yet there is a common Scottish cultural position. And you know, being South African, you know, we're complicated too. But I just want to tie it back to rugby, funny enough, and just picking up on the All Blacks and just seeing how the sport has developed and how the following has developed just around those key cultural kind of things that anchor it, and essentially just want to reflect again on what Devorah was saying about the importance of that cultural stamp.
And Ian, obviously, as John said, London is a multicultural melting pot.
Yeah, and I touched on it before when I referenced London is Open as a particular sort of campaign and a stamp, a message that we're putting out in the world of sort of increasing division in the way that political votes are going. And that's really important. We've got a new mayor now as well, and he's standing for a London for all Londoners, as the phrase he uses, and actually saying, you know, it's not for a particular privileged background, it's not for a particular sort of ethnic background or anything. You know, he's a Muslim, you know, brought up in London, son of a bus driver, and made his career and his success. And interestingly, the moment, even before he was elected, when Donald Trump made his speech about banning all Muslims, or, you know, temporary halt of all Muslims to the US, one of the first things he did was say, well, okay, so you're going to... I think it was actually just after he'd been elected, and he sort of said, "Oh, so I'm not coming then. You know, I'm the mayor of London. Are you going to turn me away at the door?" kind of thing. And I thought, as a, you know, a Londoner, you know, representing London, bang on, that's right up there. You know, just say it as you say. You're just a human being. You're just doing your business. You face up to this sort of challenge of people trying to create division, or, you know, at least perceived trying to create a division. And that's what really, I think, London particularly stands for. We've got a huge, in the UK, much, much, much heavier mix of ethnic backgrounds than we have in other areas of the UK. And so what we're going to then try and do is to say, what can we do to use an event, create an event which celebrates all great culture, from performing arts to different backgrounds, different diverse audiences in London. And we run a campaign every couple of years, which is called London's Autumn Season, every year. Sort of a small, we don't have a lot of money to do outdoor advertising or, you know, bought media, but we do a small campaign to say, come to London during the autumn. And what we're now going to do is say, well, let's create a live experience of coming to London in the autumn. So you might come and you might see the film festival, or you might go to the art fair in Regent's Park, but we're going to try and apply some of the mentality about volunteers on the streets, or about public celebrations, maybe even a free performance in the city so everybody feels engaged by it, maybe use some technology about how we live stream it, but have a period of time when London's autumn season is live, come, book now, put it on your agenda, because, you know, that's a way that we can sort of reverse engineer the idea of a major event, actually create a major event out of some of this indigenous offering and culture, and we'd love to, you know, work with people in the room and hear other people's ideas about how we might try and make that a reality from outside of a bid. You know, we're not going to bid for a major event, this is us creating something.
Well, we have time for probably about two questions if anyone wants to pick up any of the points raised by the panel this morning. Just wave your hand quite violently, otherwise I have to put my glasses back on. There we go, we have one up in the corner there. If you can say who you are and where you're from, that'd be appreciated.
Hi, it's my name's Andy Johnston from PRG, another South African. I just wanted to say to Ian about the Poppy experience, and how that sort of, someone that obviously not from London, but touched me actually, and the fact that the giveaway was, you know, we purchased one of the Poppies that was put into the ground around the, and the fascinating thing about that event for me, and I'm just saying as a person visiting the event, was the fact that, you know, you were speaking about the, you know, the fact that, you know, London's such a multicultural city, and looking around at that event, you know, you would have assumed that people that were remembering that war and the tragedy of the war would have been very sort of stereotypically, you know, one sort of gender, not gender, but culture, and it wasn't. There were people from all walks of life. And I can just congratulate you on, you know, something that really touched, you know, me and, you know, the community around me. You know, I lost a relative in that war, even though I never knew him, but it really sort of connected me back to sort of quite a really important part of life, you know.
Well, thanks. And really, I can't take any credit at all for it. So I have the best job in the world, which I can talk about London and promote London. And yeah, it's so there's so much great content, there's so many great innovative ideas. So that came from a spark of an idea and working with one of the venues in the city. So it sort of happened and other people got behind it. But it does just show that, you know, you can do these things and everybody gets it. You don't have to be, you know, a core sort of fan or a particular person that's engaged with it. The message transcends that, and I think that's what we do well.
Do we have one final question? We move on. Can I just ask my panel, therefore, very quickly, if they can just sum up in one sentence or several words, what are the key ingredients for a successful visitor experience, starting with you, John?
I think exceeding visitor expectations. Understanding what those expectations are and doing everything you can directly or influencing what you have to exceed those expectations, and recognizing some things are out of our control. So, you know, the first 8 days of Glasgow 2014 was sterling weather. That was beyond our control, but, you know, it made a huge difference to the event.
Devorah?
I suppose I always think about that, you know, that the difference between ordinary and extraordinary is that little extra. So I think it's the little things that you can do over and above what you need to do to put on a good event that is what makes the visitor experience.
She just stole my idea as well. I was going to say care and care about the detail. I think if you care about the detail, if you're true to, you know, somebody talked yesterday about being sincere and authentic. If you care about the detail, ultimately it shows and people get it and people come back and tell their friends.
Well, thank you. Where else can we discuss Kermit the Frog, Justin Bieber, and setting fire to stuff all in one panel discussion? So please join me in thanking my panel. Thank you.